Today is Friday, October 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden held competing town hall events Thursday night.
It is a presidential responsibility to lead.
But I want it to be an honest election, and so does everybody else.
Plus, the EU on Brexit.
They stand united against any of the demands that the United Kingdom is making.
And what can be done to stop the decline of freedom on the internet? Well, these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden held competing town halls on Thursday, reaching out to voters in separate forums at the same time. Michael Sullivan has more on the televised events just weeks before the election on November 3rd.
It should have been a head-to-head debate, but after Trump announced October 2nd he had contracted COVID-19, organizers made the event virtual and Trump refused to participate. Instead, there were rival town halls in the battleground states of Pennsylvania and Florida, Trump trailing in the polls and trying to make up for lost time. The event was broadcast by NBC News.
I was in North Carolina today and did a big rally with tremendous turnout, and I just feel really good. Florida, Pennsylvania, we're all over the place.
Trump defended his response to COVID-19, blocking flights from China in late January. That response gets a failing grade, said Biden, who appeared in a town hall moderated by George Stephanopoulos of ABC News.
It is a presidential responsibility to lead. And he didn't do that. He didn't talk about what needed to be done because he kept worrying, in my view, about the stock market.
Biden said Trump should have pressed state governors and mayors to enforce restrictions he says could have saved more lives. Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, is in Senate confirmation hearings this week, and if confirmed, could help decide a contested election.
It would be totally up to her. I would think that she would be able to rule either for me or against me. I don't see any conflict whatsoever.
Biden won't rule out expanding the high court to change the balance.
Well, I'm not a fan. I didn't say it depends on how this turns out.
The candidates agree on one thing.
We have an election coming up. I think it's the most important election in the history of our country.
Biden promised to work with Republicans if elected.
Because there's so many things we really do agree on.
But much separates the parties. Early voting has started in many states, and Trump warns of widespread fraud. Most election experts say that has not happened. Trump was asked if he will accept the results of the election.
And the answer is yes, I will. But I want it to be an honest election, and so does everybody else.
The candidates are scheduled to meet 1 week from now in a final face-to-face debate. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The Republican-led U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday scheduled an October 22nd vote to advance conservative appellate court judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court to the full Senate for confirmation. The move overrides Democratic Party objections. Reuters' Yahaira Yaquez reports.
Democrats on the committee protested the speed of the confirmation process, with Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal calling for the vote to be delayed indefinitely, a motion that was unsuccessful in the Republican-led Senate. Democrats criticized the process going forward this close to the election, especially after Republicans blocked President Barack Obama's nominee during the previous presidential election. Meanwhile, Graham said that there has been nothing out of the norm, and his fellow Republicans saying they had every right to proceed.
Yahya Yaquez reports for Reuters News. EU leaders gathered in Brussels Friday for a second day of the European Union summit to discuss international relations, especially EU-Africa cooperation and issues in the Eastern Mediterranean. Earlier, I spoke with Catherine Field in Paris via WhatsApp to get the details.
Thursday was essentially about Brexit and was the 27 EU leaders making it clear that they stand united against any of the demands that the United Kingdom is making as a way of having to get a special agreement for them to carry on trading with the bloc. So essentially you saw the chief negotiator coming out and saying, we're not going to move on matters that are very important to us. And that means a level playing field on the economy, on governance and on fisheries. So that was disappointing news to the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, but it was a clearer sign yet that the EU's first priority is its people, its market, 450 million people. They are going to look after their market.
And Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, this morning did say, prepare for no deal Brexit. He did not think that perhaps the two sides can reach a deal by the deadline of year's end. Switching gears to today's conversations, what was on the docket for their discussions?
Well, of course, Europe is in the midst of the coronavirus wave, the second wave. So one of the big issues, of course, was COVID, making sure that Europe still had the capacity to deal with this virus, and also making sure that the economic package that has already been put in place to help those companies and even countries struggling with the economic fallout, that they are going to be looked after. And it really did come to the fore, Steve, when we had the case of the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. She had to leave the summit urgently. She found out while she was there that she had been contact traced with someone in her team who had developed coronavirus. Also on Friday, the Finnish Prime Minister, she had to urgently leave because it transpired a member of a Finnish delegation that she'd been in contact with had contracted the coronavirus. The Polish Prime Minister couldn't go because he is also self-isolating. So that played a big part and certainly brings a question mark over whether there will be any more of these types of leaders' summits in the near future.
Speaking of the future, what's next for EU leadership?
Well, in terms of financing, that is also going to be the big issue, is they've got to find a lot of money, not just to finance any sort of COVID recovery, but also as a way to finance all the economic fallout. On other matters to do with the foreign affairs and third countries, of course, what is uppermost in their mind is what is happening in the Eastern Mediterranean. Again, looking at what Turkey is doing with its drilling off the coast of Cyprus, and also what Turkey is doing in Nagorno-Karabakh and in Libya. So that came up a lot. Again, very little, though, that the EU can do because Turkey is such a vital partner when it comes to migration. In terms of Africa, that has been the big thing that has come out of Friday. There's been, again, back with COVID, wanting to make sure that the European Union helps not just the development of a vaccine, which is needed in Africa, but also the distribution. Also, the discussion on debt relief for some African countries. And the EU leaders said that by the end of November, they will be able to start talking about some sort of debt relief for some of those African countries that are really struggling with the COVID effect on their economy.
Catherine Field reports from Paris, France. Some areas in Italy are facing a rapid increase in coronavirus cases. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma reports.
A virologist working in Milan tells the AP the nation has 2 weeks to stop the rising rate of transmission of coronavirus, or it risks following in the footsteps of European neighbours, where exponential spreads have ushered back harsh restrictions. Italian health officials have declared that the resurgence of COVID-19 has reached an acute phase, saying the surge, which hit pandemic highs of new daily infections this week, is not the result of record testing, as policymakers have suggested, but a sign of a real return among the population most at risk. I'm Charles Della Desma.
Italy has about 381,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and around the world, there have been about 39 million cases and nearly 1.1 million deaths. VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. And coming up later.
Since 2010, the internet has been growing less and less free. This is largely because what was once viewed as a liberating technology and social media platforms were once viewed as a place that were going to give people more freedom. Now, government authorities, private companies, and other non-state actors have figured out that they can also exploit the internet.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft has been orbiting and making observations of the asteroid Bennu since 2018. One of the most important aspects of the mission is a maneuver called touch and go, or tag. That's when the spacecraft will be sent to the surface of the asteroid so that it can scoop up at least 60 grams of material that will be sent back to Earth for study. The capsule containing the samples is expected to reach Earth in 2023. Scientists theorize that Bennu contains substances that date back to the early days of the solar system and compounds that may have triggered life on Earth. The tag maneuver is scheduled to take place at 10 hours and 12 minutes UTC on October 20th. At its equator, Bennu has a radius of about 282 meters and is approximately 331 million kilometers from Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The coronavirus pandemic that has gripped the world in 2020 has increased poverty and hunger for many, according to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, known as the FAO. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports that the problem is not a lack of food, but access to it, according to the organization.
The UN's Food and Agricultural Organization says its efforts to fight hunger have been set back 10 years due to the coronavirus pandemic. FAO's chief economist, Maximo Torero Collins, says the problem is not a lack of food, but access to it.
People won't have access to food because they are losing their jobs, because they don't have the income. Developing countries will be facing significant challenges because of recession in the world. And therefore, that is what explains why undernourishment could increase to 132 million and poverty.
He predicts poverty will get worse.
We are expecting an increase in poverty, which goes up to 150 million more people moving into extreme poverty. We are expecting up to 132 million people moving to undernourishment.
The most vulnerable, he says, are those exposed to unrest or climate change.
In sub-Saharan Africa, in the Sahel area, most of them were already facing conflict. Most of them were already facing huge shocks of climate, or they were facing locust, the problem that we have in Eastern Africa.
East Africa saw a devastating outbreak of locust swarms this year. In Kenya, it was the worst plague of the voracious insects in 70 years, taking a toll on the livelihood of millions. Although the pandemic has hit other parts of the world harder, such as in the United States and Europe, a survey by the International Committee of the Red Cross found that respondents in Africa have been affected since the start of the pandemic. ICRC's Alimatu Amadou spoke to VOA from Dakar.
And this survey was done among 2,400 people in 10 African countries. And what those people we have interviewed say is really a worrying. For example, 94% have told us that the prices of the food has increased in their local markets. We also see that 82% of the people interviewed said that they lost income or revenue.
She says only 7% of the people said they had enough savings to cope with the current situation.
So in Burkina Faso, there are 2.8 million people who face crisis level of food insecurity or worse. It's actually 200% more than last year. What we see is that there are now more than 1 million people being displaced, and those people have lost access to arable land. And usually it has been made even more difficult for them to access enough food.
Beyond Africa, the FAO is particularly worried about Latin America, which has also been hit hard by COVID-19. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Former Mexican Defense Secretary General Salvador Cienfuegos, who led the country's army for 6 years under ex-President Enrique Peña Nieto, has been arrested Thursday on drug trafficking and money laundering charges at Los Angeles International Airport. Cienfuegos was a powerful figure in Mexico's drug war, in which the army battled cartels across the country. Several of Mexico's former top-ranking drug war officials have been implicated in the illegal narcotics trade. A U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration spokeswoman told Reuters News she did not have further details on the arrest. The Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Thai police used water cannons and pushed forward with riot shields and batons Friday to try to disperse thousands of protesters who defied a ban on protests for a second day and in spite of a warning from Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-Cha. Hundreds of Thai anti-government protesters chanted "Down with dictatorship" under pouring rain in Bangkok. Police on Friday closed roads and put up barricades around a major intersection where the protesters have vowed to gather again to push their demands, including that Prime Minister Prayut leave office, the constitution be amended, and the nation's monarchy undergo reform. Freedom House is a U.S. government-funded advocacy group that focuses on democracy, political freedom, and human rights. In their new report, the group has found that for the 10th consecutive year, internet freedom has been on the decline. Ali Funk is a senior research analyst for technology and democracy at Freedom House and is co-author of the report. I began our conversation by asking her why there's been 10 straight years of decline.
Since 2010, the internet has been growing less and less free. This is largely because what was once viewed as a liberating technology and social media platforms were once viewed as a place that were going to give people more freedom. Now, government authorities, private companies, and other non-state actors have figured out that they can also exploit the internet and associated digital technologies for their own political or social gain.
So what kind of trends are you seeing in terms of, you know, what these government or other organizations are doing?
So 2020 brought us the COVID-19 pandemic. And what we've realized and what we've seen in our research is that the pandemic has really accelerated society's reliance on digital technologies. So now everything is virtually online, from going to get to the doctor, to getting education, to simply working or talking with loved ones. And this is happening at a time when the internet is becoming less and less free. So state and non-state actors in many countries are really exploiting opportunities created by the health crisis to shape their own online narratives, to censor critical speech or unfavorable news, and really build new technological systems of social control that are laying down the foundation for a future surveillance state.
All right, so let's turn to the report itself and kind of get into the nuts and bolts of what you found out. In terms of areas that are seeing reductions in internet freedom, you know, where are you seeing this taking place the most?
So there's been a decline in internet freedom, as we mentioned, for 10 consecutive years. And it's really happening in every region of the world. So this year's biggest declines took place in Myanmar and Kyrgyzstan. Myanmar specifically, government authorities cut off the internet in villages in the Rakhine and Chin states, which is home to the Rohingya population that has long been dealing with human rights abuses by the military. And then the next level of declines occurred in India, Ecuador, and Nigeria, so really spanning the globe. We also saw a decline in internet freedom in the United States, which dropped its ranking to only be 7th in the world. And then again, for the 6th consecutive year, China ranked worst of the worst.
Is it all bad news? Is anyone improving how they use the internet in terms of freedom?
We have some positive stories, which I think we all need some positive news right now. So 22 countries overall out of the 65 countries we covered did improve compared to the 26 that declined. So Iceland, again, came in first place, followed closely by Estonia and Canada. Some of our other big improvements included Sudan, Zimbabwe as well. And then one of the big positive themes that we're seeing this year is really how courts in a range of countries, from Pakistan and India to Brazil, Germany, and the U.S., it's really the courts that are stepping up to protect human rights online.
So I guess the question I have is, you know, you're with Freedom House. What does your organization see as the role of the internet in the 21st century?
It's a great question. So we think the internet, it can still be a platform for freedom, and it can still bring about more democracy. Freedom House is an independent organization, and we've been focusing on the defense and expansion of democracy since 1941. And I think, you know, even though we see the internet being manipulated, especially around, you know, election times in the U.S. and the lead up to the November election, we've also seen this past year the internet being a place for digital organizing and activism. Protests have just been erupting around the world over the past 2 years, in Hong Kong, in the U.S., in Lebanon, in Sudan. And these tools are such important places for folks to organize and come together, to create a shared avenue for change, and then to really push for that change and push their governments to be more democratic.
We started this conversation by commenting that your organization has seen a 10-year steady decline in internet freedom. What kind of recommendations does your organization have to reverse it?
We lay out recommendations for governments, tech companies, and civil society. And we lay them out by different themes. So, for example, for censorship, we want democratic governments to limit the export of censorship technology that is being used by countries that Freedom House ranks not free and partly free. A great example is in Belarus. A U.S. company actually provided censorship tools to the government that then allowed them to block websites amid mass protests. We also are calling on governments to not shut down the internet and to not block or ban social media platforms. There are more productive ways to get at the very serious concerns around social media platforms, such as, you know, privacy issues or disinformation issues, that doesn't result in a total ban of the tools. We're also calling in the surveillance space for governments to make sure that their surveillance abides by democratic principles. So it needs to be very transparent. It must have independent oversight, grounded in law.
That was Freedom House's Senior Research Analyst for Technology and Democracy, Ali Funk. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 18th, Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita was ousted in a widely condemned military takeover. The United States immediately halted its security assistance to the government in Mali. And the West African Regional Economic Bloc, ECOWAS, suspended Mali from its institutions and imposed sanctions, pending the formation of a civilian transitional government. In late September, Ba Ndaw, a retired colonel, was appointed transitional president in Mali. Colonel Assimi Goïta, head of the junta that staged the coup, was installed as Mali's new transitional vice president. Civilian diplomat and former foreign minister Mokhtar Wan was named as transitional prime minister. They will be tasked with overseeing an 18-month civilian transition culminating with democratic elections. On October 5th, the transitional president, Ba Ndaw, named the full cabinet. ECOWAS then lifted sanctions. The United States views the establishment of this transitional government as an initial step towards a return to constitutional order. State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortega said, "We urge the transitional government to honor its commitments to the economic community of West African states, including holding democratic elections within 18 months. It will also be important for the transitional government to fulfill its pledges to the Malian people to strengthen governance, combat corruption, reform electoral processes, and implement the 2015 Agreement for Peace and Reconciliation in Mali." U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Kelly Craft stressed that the United States will not accept military control over civilian authorities, delays to elections, or elections that are not credible. Elections must also include the full, effective, and meaningful participation of women, internally displaced peoples and refugees, youth populations, and marginalized northern groups. The United States is standing with the Malian people and has earmarked $54 million in new humanitarian assistance for Mali. Spokesperson Ortega said, "We firmly believe that a democratic, prosperous, and secure Mali is essential to the future of the Sahel region." As a partner of Mali for over 60 years, the United States will work with all who are committed to these goals. Now is the time for Malians to come together to build a better, brighter future for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.